Welcome to An Honorable Profession, a podcast giving America hope since 2018. I'm Ryan Coonerty. Along with Debbie Cox Bolton of The New Deal, I'm lucky enough to be your co-host. An Honorable Profession is a New Deal Leaders podcast. The New Deal is an organization that supports the next generation of American leaders. From attorneys generals, to state senators, to mayors, to school board members, these are the people that are pushing policies and politics that will respond to climate change, rebuild our economy, address racial injustice, and restore our democracy. These are incredibly talented people who have dedicated themselves to public service when their country and their communities needed it the most. Check out newdealleaders.org to see what I'm talking about. Today, I'm talking with Michigan Senator and congressional candidate, Christa McDonald Rivett. Michigan is ground zero for American politics these days. A swing state under Democratic leadership that is adapting to the changing economy, addressing the public's frustration with our politics, and enduring threats from insurrectionists. McDonald Rivett is at the center in one way or another of all these issues. She's smart, completely dedicated to public service, and insanely busy. Stick around to hear how she uses the power of a post-it note to keep her focused on what's important. Enjoy. Senator Christa McDonald Rivett, welcome to An Honorable Profession.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be here.
I'm so excited to talk to you today. Michigan is a critical state. You are serving in the state Senate. You are running for Congress. There's probably no one who has a better sense of what's going on the ground in Michigan right now. Why don't you let us know how things are going for your citizenry and what things look like politically?
Yeah, happy to. So, you know, Michigan is one of the states that we call the Blue Wall. So it's us, Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, that we feel a lot of pressure right now. So you probably know that there was a really big change in Michigan 2 years ago, where we moved from complete Republican control of the legislature to complete Democratic control of the legislature. I serve in the state Senate right now, and it was my Senate seat that flipped the Michigan State Senate blue for the first time in almost 40 years. So it's been a bit of a wild ride, but it's also been this extraordinary time where we have been able to, in a Democratic trifecta, move a lot of really important policy that impacts Michigan families, and most of it has been stuck for decades. And there's a lot going on in Michigan right now, but it's been a really gratifying time to be able to serve in the legislature.
Michigan is so interesting because now that the Democrats do control the state, you are really pushing really great policies, as you say, that have been stuck for a long time. At the same time, you're dealing with insurrectionists and threats to elected officials. And at the same time, as you said, you're under all this pressure as part of the Blue Wall to maintain sanity in our federal government and frankly, in the whole world.
No pressure.
So with those three major trends colliding all at once, and in many ways in your own personal life, why don't we start by first talking about what is some of that legislation that you've been excited to move over the last couple of years and then look forward to moving in this session?
Okay. So a couple of things that are important to understand about Michigan. So we talk all the time in Michigan that we are the state that put the country on wheels and home to the UAW and really was a kind of the birthplace of a lot of manufacturing. But what we've seen over time is that Michigan now has a declining population, an aging population, and a lot of our jobs are low wage. In fact, 60% of our jobs right now in Michigan pay less than $50,000 a year. So when you put that on top of this space where we have rising prescription drug costs, we have housing costs, childcare, all of these things create this pressure in Michigan where families are really hurting. So our priorities in our caucus, our priority as Democrats in Michigan is in that economic space of more money in pockets. How do we raise our median income? How do we increase our population? But we do this thing that I think about it as the Michigan dream. And for anybody who's from this part of the country, you'll know that we all have this American dream of opportunity, comes from hard work. So if you get up every day and you work really hard, you should be able to own a home and save for retirement and raise your kids. And the Michigan dream part of that is what we all love to do is every couple of years, you kind of throw the kids in the back seat and you head to Disney World because that's the pinnacle, right? I have Mickey Mouse ears from the 70s when my parents, you know, we were in that station wagon doing that. And my dad worked construction, and that used to be really a possible thing. You could make a really good average middle class life and make that happen. But that's not a reality for most people here anymore. And I mean, most people, we have a million kids living in a household where their basic needs are a question every day. So that's what we talked about. And for a couple of years before I went in the state Senate, I was championing and putting together a coalition externally on the Working Families Tax Credit, which based on the EITC, but was actual dollars up to $3,500 in people's pockets that have household incomes below $62,000 a year. And nothing. We could get one legislative hearing, couldn't really get it through, had a supportive governor, but was not moving. Other important pieces, like our continuous attack on collective bargaining, the rights to organize, wasn't moving anywhere. Our gun violence prevention legislation introduced, even after Oxford, we could not get a legislative hearing. So suddenly, January 2023, we have a Democratic trifecta. So my first bill introduced, that was the first person to testify in the new legislature on the Working Families Tax Credit. We got that to the governor's desk within 3 months, $500 million worth of tax cuts for working families. And we were one of the first states in the country to roll back right to work. We restored prevailing wage. We really started immediately going on a very strong agenda. We moved very quickly. And the reason we can move very quickly is because these are pieces of legislation that had just been blocked for years and years and years. So that was extremely gratifying. And it's not every day as a legislator that you get to say, hey, I sponsored legislation that will bring tens of thousands of kids out of poverty. We all know policy is incremental, legislation is incremental. But this we were able to do really quickly. And the other piece that I think there were a lot of things that we did that we have done that really mattered. But for me, my first public act was a gun violence prevention act. I was a part of my local, I'm a community kind of organizing person at heart. I was a part of the Moms Demand Action work way before I ran for office and really discovered that it was possible to not only get hearings on these common sense pieces of legislation, but we actually were able to move them. And unfortunately, we did that in the wake of the mass shooting at Michigan State. And we never want anything like that to happen. So my first piece of legislation had to do with safe storage of firearms. So I really believe strongly that if you have that right, comes with a responsibility. And so if you have a firearm and you do not properly store it, and a child gets a hold of it and hurts themselves or someone else, you're criminally liable. And we were able to pass that and get that to the governor's desk last year as well. So it's been a really interesting environment, a really exciting time to serve as a Democrat in Michigan. And we also have, I would say, the most kick-ass governor in the entire country.
As a Californian, I might argue, but no, I'll give it to you. She is doing really, really amazing things and real back to basics stuff that will hopefully resonate on the ground.
Right.
Tell me how some of these policies, are they translating into optimism and support on the ground? If you take the investments that Michigan's making, plus some of the federal investments through the Inflation Reduction Act and infrastructure, are people feeling these positive benefits, or are they still frustrated and angry and feel like government isn't responding?
I would say it's yes to both.
Okay.
I think it's really important as elected political leaders, regardless of what level of government we're serving in, that we have this responsibility to infuse political conversation with a sense of hope about our future. And we just don't hear a lot of that. That includes our side of the aisle. There's this tendency right now in our, what I would call, really broken politics to predict catastrophe and to sort of glom on to that space that we see in social media and other curated by algorithm news sources that really make people feel hopeless. And so while we've had these really big legislative wins that are tangible dollars in people's pockets, we're always pushing back against that source of this broken political system that divides us, that is really making folks feel tired in our souls about our future. And I really get worried about that when we start talking to our young adults who will say they don't expect to own a home, that they don't believe, that they get really turned off by politics because suddenly they are worried about losing rights and whether or not they'll ever be able to afford to have kids and the state of the climate. And we don't have a lot of politicians on either side that are talking about a hopeful vision of what is possible, and how this idea of thinking about the extraordinary future that can be possible for our country is actually a part of patriotism. So it's both. I think one of the reasons why I am in elected office, why I am pursuing other elected offices, is to try to put a new kind of face on how we think about our government, how we think about our country, how we think about our state, and what that means as a community, and how we can all come together so that we all can thrive.
Yeah. In reading about your campaign, I was struck by the fact that you really embrace a sense of patriotism, and there's not a lot of hedging around it, as some folks in the Democratic Party tend to do. You're straightforward and you're optimistic, and you're pushing first the Michigan dream and an American dream. Can you talk about that decision to embrace that style of optimism and in your campaigns and in your policies?
It was interesting, as it wasn't a decision. It's just basically who I am. I was born in 1970 and raised in a working class household, was really taught about the greatness that is possible in our country. I have a bachelor's degree in American history. I think it's possible for us to think about our country, to think about what is happened in our past and celebrate that, while at the same time, we are critically looking at some of the things that we are not proud of as a country, and use that to think forward about how we come together. But I am an absolute patriot. And I think as a party, we give up on that word and shouldn't. But I also believe in this idea of community. And I have this bracelet I wear. It says hope. And it's because that is at the core of, if you are not hopeful about what we can do together as a country, which in its core is about us all coming together around a bright sort of future about what's possible. If you don't believe in that, you should not be trying to be active in politics. This is the most fundamental thing. And it's being hopeful about our country and hopeful about what's possible on the streets we live on, right, with our neighbors, as well as thinking about these really big issues as a country and what our role is around the world. All of it needs to center around well-being and what's possible for us to be able to do. But I also am very realistic. I've spent 30 years working in public policy related to kids' issues, working in education, and particularly the early education space. We have a lot of room to grow in the kind of pathways we're creating for our kids. There are things that we have to look at with discipline and urgency, but we can't do it out of a sense of despair, and we certainly can't do it using anger as a tool to get ourselves elected or to get ourselves extra Twitter followers. That's not leadership. That's just trying to be an entertainer on social media.
Couldn't agree more. Absolutely. I want to talk about your career into public service. I love the Great Start Initiative that you worked on. And you had this whole career well before becoming an elected official of trying to move public policy outcomes. Can you talk a little bit about that experience? And then also, frankly, what it was like to transition from asking for a hearing, advocating for a hearing, to actually being able to call a hearing, and what you've learned from your experience on both sides of the table.
That's such an interesting question. So the first thing I need to tell you is that my husband and I together have 6 kids. And so to me, the most hopeful act anyone can do is bring new life into the world. But it's really centered in this practice. I'm very pragmatic and very practical. You have to be when you're raising a million children. But interesting, I started my career doing campaign politics. And I always knew what my why was going to be, what my central mission was going to be, and that was creating a better life path for children. I just always knew that that's what I was going to work on. And I thought in my early 20s that the best way to do that was to get involved in campaigns and politics and get the right people elected. And I still believe in that. But I honestly worked for a while and I found myself getting people elected that I wouldn't necessarily vote for. And I did an about face. I left politics in the mid 90s to try to just do something else and went to go work for Head Start. And I was their state advocate, their state lobbyist for Head Start. And the thing that a lot of people don't know about this free, federally funded preschool program is that it's a requirement that half of the board, the decision makers, have to be parents. Active parents. So when you are trying to develop policy and you do it with moms who are living at the federal poverty level and actively parenting a toddler, your perspective changes on what works, what's important, and what can be negotiated. And it set this tone for how I've thought about policy for the rest of my career. So I've done a lot of work inside state government. I spent about a decade working in philanthropy in the city of Detroit. We were inside the neighborhoods, working alongside residents. But that idea that policy has to be developed around a big table with the people who are impacted, not the people who have studied. Those folks are important. But what we really have to do is build coalitions around big ideas, and that's how you get lasting change. So I've worked my entire career to try to think about where, with the skills that I have, with the experiences I've had, everybody's got that unique set, where is the most powerful place I can put myself to actually move those outcomes, particularly for children? And had walked away from politics in my 20s, found myself in my 50s, had a very, very good friend of mine come up and talk to me and say, "Kristen, we have the chance to take control of the Michigan Senate for the first time in 40 years. And the key to that is the district you live in, and we think you're the only one who can win it." And that felt like a whole lot of pressure to me. And so I said no. And then thoughtfully, prayerfully considered it with my family. The other thing I do that's unusual as a Democrat is I talk about my faith and how important that is and how it helps me make decisions, and realized that that pivot, that move into public service, which is what I think elected office is, and in that way could really make some differences. And so launched into the campaign. Mine was the seat that flipped the Senate. I have the Democratic base in my Senate seat is 48%. And we built the coalition. I'm not making this up. Thousands of people. On any given Saturday, you could find 100 people on the doors in my campaign. Knocked on 75,000 doors. We raised about $1 million in my state Senate campaign, but our average contribution was around $30. And, you know, we did it like I did everything else in my life. We just brought a lot of people together. And we have this phrase in every campaign I'm involved in and in my Senate office. It's we, not me. And we're doing this for a reason. And that has made, honestly, all the difference, because that campaign was hard. Campaigns are awful. You get a lot of lies put up about you. You know, people say terrible things. But always I had this group of people that were right along with me every step of the way. And there's the same coalition that we pull on when we're deciding what pieces of legislation we're going to introduce, how we're going to do it, where we should put our priorities. And honestly, it's made all the difference for me.
Can you tell us how, for somebody who's sitting at home and maybe wanting to run for office for the first time or run for a higher office, and they're like, "I should build a coalition. I should have a team of 100 people out walking." That is really, really hard to do. Tell me, how do you go about starting from the "yes, I'll run" to creating a movement?
So it starts with one person. Person to person, conversation to conversation. So we started building teams and pulled everybody I knew together and said, "I'm going to run for the Senate." This latest thing, I honestly pulled everybody I knew together and said, "Hey, I'm going to run for Congress. And what's the next step?" And, you know, when we were building it from scratch, because in the community I live in my state Senate, there'd been years and years and years since there'd been a competitive Senate seat there. So there was no infrastructure. There wasn't that like long list of volunteers that someone hands you and suddenly you just start dialing them up and you have volunteers. But it really has to be starts with your personal network. And I went into, we did these things. I still do them. I love them. I call them front porch talks. And I would go to a friend of mine who lived in a neighborhood where I didn't know anybody and said, "Hey, will you have a front porch talk? Will you invite 15 to 20 of your neighbors over, sit on your front porch, serve whatever beverage that you want, and we just talk politics for an hour?" And it's, you know, we call it, it's BYOC, bring your own chair. So people literally bring lawn chairs. We sit in driveways, we sit in front yards, and we talk. We have conversations. It's not me talking at them. It's having a back and forth. We debate policy. We talk about whatever's going on in the moment. And we just started doing those over and over and over again. And so by the time we got a couple of months into the campaign, we were doing two or three a week. And it's amazing what comes out of that in how you think about the world, how you think about policy. And then we just started knocking on people's doors. But I think the thing that I would say that's really important is I would go up to doors that would be flying the Donald Trump flags because I wanted to know, right? I live in a community that used to be solidly blue and now is pretty red. And I'd knock on the door and they would say, well, I used to be a Democrat, but I voted for Donald Trump. And I would say, well, I'm not running against Donald Trump. But then I said what I think is the most powerful thing you can say in politics. Tell me about that. Tell me about that. And then I stopped talking and really listening where people are and what they're feeling and abandoning this idea of this kind of avatar of an opposition of this is the profile of the person. This is what we think about them and realizing that it's a human being across from you. And when you're on their front porch and you're talking to them and you're actually talking to them and asking questions that you listen to the answers to, that's how you start to build a coalition. That's how you, and we did that. We did that on 75,000 doors. We knocked on Republican doors. And at the end of the day, 48% Democratic base, I won with over 53% of the vote. We got Republicans to cross the ballot. And they did it because they could see that I was the same like person that could be standing next to them in the line at the grocery store. And I always laugh because I say, look, I got a 14-year-old boy at home. He drinks 2 gallons of milk a week. I care about the price of groceries. These are things that I worry about too. And I remember being able to go to Disney World with my dad, who was a construction worker, but know that many of our families can no longer take vacations. They simply can't afford them. And that's what people really want to talk about. And that's what public service is. So I think that's how you build a coalition. But the other piece that I always say to people who are thinking about getting into these roles is that it is public service. So when I was elected and then I came into the Senate and it's big, beautiful, fancy office and I've got staff. And frankly, people say, well, Senator, and they'll open a door for you. And the first thing I did is, you know, I walked in and I sat down at my big wood desk and, you know, could see the Capitol. And I took out a post-it note and I wrote, you are not that important. And I put it on my computer screen because there's a reason why I am here. And that is because there's a reason why we are here, that coalition, I press the button, but it is the coalition that puts me here. And so it's easy to forget when the title comes along, why you decided to do it in the first place. But if you're wanting to do this because of the big office and the title and the deference, you will really fail at what you're doing and you won't enjoy it. Have a why. Know why you're doing it and make sure you're staying connected to people that will remind you that there are hundreds of thousands of people behind you when you are pressing a button, making a decision, introducing big pieces of legislation.
I love that. And it's so important to remember because also inevitably everybody leaves office. And if your identity is tied up in people calling you senator, you watch a lot of people who have a lot of talent and a lot of things to offer the world just slip away or hang on to the past. And so it's a great reminder to just do good while you're there and then be ready to move on. I'm curious, when you knocked on those doors of folks who used to be Democrats and they voted for Donald Trump, and you know, I think all of us have this idea of who the opposition is and what they care about, but what did you hear from them when you engaged, and especially going into this year, how movable are they from continuing to support him or consider another candidate?
I know that a lot of the people that I talk to that used to be Democrats and are voting for Donald Trump now feel they are ignored by the Democratic Party. They feel that they are looked down upon as seen as less than. Well, I always talk about, look, terms like redneck, those are slurs, right? And this idea that I think we really have to examine and look at is that the people that are voting for Donald Trump are in some way not informed or not educated enough to understand that is not the case. That is not the case. There are people who are watching there worried about being able to have a retirement that allows them to have a standard of living. We're seeing a rising senior poverty rate. And these are people who have worked their entire lives and suddenly they are picking up jobs at Walmart or McDonald's in order to supplement their income. They're watching their neighborhoods deteriorate as the housing stock starts to break down and they really feel like they are ignored and not listened to. And I think that that's fair in some cases, and in others, it's just a lot of where they're getting information. And we have so many households that have Fox News on 24/7, and they hear repetitive over and over and over again, conspiracy theories, things that they think the Democratic Party is responsible for. But what I really believe is that people want to be represented by someone they think understands their day-to-day and the worries they have, and most of those worries are financial.
Yeah. So in the last couple minutes here, you're moving this legislation in Michigan. You're part of a critical majority, but you want to take those skills to Washington, D.C., where it, from the outside, looks like it's going to be a lot harder to move legislation or even live in a fact-based environment. And so tell us about the decision to run and what you're hoping to do if elected.
I do think that there are folks who are asking me this question of, why do you want to go work in what is arguably one of the most toxic work environments in the world? To that, I say, aren't you tired of this system? Aren't you just like me, tired of a political system that is not only dysfunctional and weaponizing fear, turning it into hate, but is also breaking our country apart? And we are starving, I think, for political leaders who are willing to put forward a hopeful vision and are going to talk in a way in our communities that allows us to connect to our neighbor, not point a finger at them and fight. And it's that weariness, right? The weariness that I think we all feel that is possible to change. And I think it happens one person at a time. And while it is elected people, maybe one elected person at a time, more importantly, it's probably one conversation at a time on the doors, on the phones, and in the grocery store, where we are again able to debate ideas and not be offended when someone doesn't agree with you, believing that it makes your idea stronger when you can debate it with someone that's a friend when you start and a friend when you end. But also that we believe that our political leaders, our public servants, have a responsibility to unite us and inspire us about what's possible in our country. And as a patriot, I just know that we can get there. I'm not foolish. I know this is going to take a while, but I think it's possible. I believe in hope. And so I threw my hat in the ring and charge forward with my eyes wide open into this election cycle, which is going to be interesting for sure.
Well, I hope we can get there too. I think we have a better shot at it with you being part of New Deal and the very good public service that you are doing in Michigan when we need it the most. And so thank you for joining us today, and thank you for your service, and thank you for figuring out how to manage those kids, the legislature, a congressional campaign, and everything else that you're balancing right now. I have no idea how you do it, but I'm amazed to hear about it during this podcast.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
An Honorable Profession is a New Deal Leaders podcast. Thanks to the team at New Deal for producing this episode. We encourage you to bring honor to public service, and because we keep things honorable, no tax dollars are used in the making of this podcast.